Hello and welcome to what is the 122nd episode of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Interviewer 1, and him.
Interviewer 2.
Oh, we're just kidding. It's me, Al Coates, yeah, and him.
Scott Cassin-Rennie. We couldn't not, could we?
Oh, we were deeply offended. We have names. We're people. We're people.
I think you might have to give a bit of background to that one in a minute, but yeah, anyway.
Well, I will, yeah. We'll reveal all as the conversation goes on. Well, how the hell are you, Scott? It's mid-July and the sun is high in the sky. How's Trix?
I know. It is. It's very high in the sky here in Ireland for a change, actually. We've had such glorious weather. It's been beautiful. Beautiful. It has. Beautiful.
Smashing.
And yes, life is meh at the minute, but we're all right. We're surviving and thriving. Are we thriving? Yeah, we're thriving. Yeah.
That is such a confused message.
I'm trying to convince myself.
Yeah. If you say it enough, it'll be true, won't it?
Bear in mind, we're like six weeks into the summer holidays already. So,
six weeks in? My goodness.
End of May, so what is that? Mid-July.
Blimey.
Yeah.
I'm just holding that on camp for a second. What sort of camp?
A drama camp. It's in, yeah, no. Couldn't make it up, could you?
Yeah, is this the drama camp?
Is this where I do all the drama? Like, all the drama. It's a school that they use. Obviously, it didn't happen last year. It's a private school that they use during the summer. It didn't happen last year, so it happened this year. He was itching to go. We were itching for him to go as well.
I bet you were.
But it's all outside this year, obviously. And he had to have a PCR test, and he's had to do antigen testing while he's there, and blah 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 blah. So I'm going to insist, before he comes back, that they pay for the PCR test before he comes back home, so that I know, just get my money back somehow.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. So, we can't have him back. He's deeply unwell.
Exactly. No, sorry, you'll have to keep him for another 14 days.
14 days. Oh, genius. That is absolute genius, isn't it?
I thought so. I was quite impressed with my thinking skills on that one.
Excellent, because I know my kids have been talking about, you know, ways of scamming the tests. So you get tests and there's all kinds of like harebrained school kid ideas about lemon juice and freezing them and, you know, howling at the moon and stuff. Yeah,
we've gone that far. Well, the interesting thing about over here is that schools and kind of that antigen testing hasn't taken place over here. So that was our first family experience, and obviously it didn't happen to me or Tris or the other boys, but that was our first experience having to be tested in any way, shape or form. We've not had to do any of that because they don't do it in schools here. And I think a lot of that's to do with the fact that there is a national health system, but it's not the same as the UK, if that makes sense. So they're really not up on the antigen stuff yet. So it was interesting when he went for it.
And we've got those.
He came home and he went, "I've not got a gag reflex." And I was like, "That's a lovely story. Let's move on before you start anything else."
Oh, good grief.
Yeah, I know. We don't need to
know. I've got a hypersensitive gag reflex. So I've been, the sound of me doing a test is literally like someone coughing up a lung. It's retching and gagging and, it's awful experience.
You know, as an onlooker, that sort of stuff is hilarious for me because I have another friend who we were on holiday together and we had a Jack and Jill bathroom. We were staying at somebody's house and there was a Jack and Jill bathroom and he was brushing his teeth in the morning. And then the retching from brushing his teeth. I mean, brushing his teeth. Yeah, so, yeah, I get quite a little bit of hilarity out of things like that.
Sadistic pleasure.
Can we talk about projectile vomiting with you? You know, don't. I mean, that's it. You've gone. Yeah.
Stop starting. I'm going to take a deep breath before we go on.
Yeah.
I feel like it's been ages since we've talked. Like, you know, talked. We've been putting lots of podcasts out, but interesting days. So, I thought tonight we would, we've got a little running order. We were going to talk about a few things. One of them was, I think, really good to reflect on the Josh McAllister interview, you know, the Independent Care Review for England. Scott, is that your Twitch coming back? Is that
That's my Twitch. Yeah, yeah. I'll really have Tourette's in a minute as well. But anyway,
don't joke about that. You know, no, we'll get letters.
No. Yeah, we will. Oh well, never mind. Eh? We've had enough.
Add them to the bunch. Well, it's been flamboyant. Yeah. So tell me, reflecting flamboyant, it has been interesting. I'm going to be really careful because I kind of use what language a bit loosely, and it's all been everyone's picked up on my words.
Yes. I think that is probably the top out of 10 points. That's probably top one. The first point is language. I think we have had a week and a bit of it. And I think that, you know, there's a couple of things that I've mentioned in other quarters that I'm going to mention here again. The first thing is that we invited Josh to come on.
Mm.
Yeah. There was never, and do you know what? If anybody wants them, we can send them the email trail that says we invited him on. And there was never one point where we were asked to edit or to ask questions or edit our questions. He didn't know what we were going to ask. He knew nothing about what we were going to ask. How? What do you mean?
I got an email about 3 days before saying, what are you going to talk about? And I told them, and they went, all right, fine.
Right. Yeah, but they didn't dictate to us what we could and couldn't ask.
Oh, it was really broad. I said, we talk about some of the criticisms of the review. We talk about how it's going. I couldn't be bothered. I'm not getting to questions. I'm not playing that game again. The DFE incident, which we shall not speak of.
Yeah, no, never speak of that again. And the other thing was it was recorded on the Tuesday and it went out on the Saturday.
Yeah.
It wasn't live. It wasn't recorded and just released. And we did honestly ask him, you know, and that's quite obvious from the transcription. Is that the right word? Transcription?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Transcription.
Yeah.
Dr. Donna, can't remember her surname.
Peach.
That's it. Dr. Donna Peach started transcribing it. We were like, what are you doing? Because of the context of the discussions, etc., and I've realised I'm actually a useless interviewer, and I am, and all that sort of stuff. And that is our little joke earlier about interviewer one and interviewer two, because that's how we started off until she got used to our voices.
It was literally a verbatim Twitter thread that was going in. Tweet after tweet after tweet, which is fine if people want to do that. My nervousness around that is I know that I could say to you, Scott, I hate you. And there's so many ways I can put an intonation on that and so many contexts that it can mean a dozen different things to a dozen different people in different ways.
Yeah.
It's only a shadow of what was actually communicated.
Yeah. Because you don't hear the tone, you don't hear because you have said quite often on here that you hate me, but you've said it in a jokey manner. Even though you mean it, you said it in a jokey manner so that people don't think you actually do hate me. And that's fine. I get that, you know.
Right, and it's true. I do hate you. But
I'm ending this call. Goodbye.
I've taken solace in it because if people want to listen to it, it was the episode before last. It was a week past Saturday, whatever date that was, the first one in July. And I think for me, what was really interesting was Josh was really pleased with the interview because then the Care Review tweeted different snippets of it. And then lots of people who perhaps had alternative views to that then quoted bits of it. And I thought, well, one sense we've got a little bit of balance there because everyone came away thinking that it confirmed what they thought.
Yeah.
So it was a fair reflection. And we weren't, you know, we've been ongoing even till today, we've had sort of difficult email exchange or private message exchanges people genuinely thinking that there was some nefarious plot because we didn't ask for questions beforehand, like from the general public or from the community. But to be honest,
I was just going to say, I mean, if we were to have done this with this, we have an hour, and any more than an hour on a podcast, people start to go, okay, that's really boring now and I'm going to switch off, right? We try and stick to an hour where possible. We have some podcasts that have gone over that, but that's because of the content or, you know, we've been in a flow or we've been talking about something that's really relevant. Now, I'm not saying the Care Review isn't really relevant. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying an interview with
someone
like Josh. Yeah. And we're laughing, but that's our podcast. You know, we've been even been criticised for kind of having a little bit of a humorous edge to it. Now, I'm really sorry if you took offence to that. You're probably not listening if you did take offence to it, because you've probably blocked us and all that. That's fine. I get that. But that is our way. That is what we base this podcast on. We base it on our humour, in terms of, you know, we make a really tricky subject listenable in terms of a podcast. And that is our approach. I make no apology for that. But I also make no apology for having a guest on who I am not going to treat any differently to any other guest. Okay. We had an hour with him. Okay. And we had an hour that we try to address as many issues as possible. You've pointed out your language, not bad language, just the way you word things. You know, I was thinking afterwards, and I there was people saying about the kind of the vitriolic kind of exchange of tweets and exchanges on social media and stuff. And it reminded me of what that referred to, who that referred to. And I acknowledged that actually, had we not necessarily researched properly, because we had done our research, but we should have kind of created a bit more of a balance to that. However, that said, that person felt attacked, and that's how they reacted. So, you know, I can't, we were just the interviewers. That's,
you know. The thing is that language of, you know, social media frenzy, vitriolic Twitter attacks, you know, that was our language, and Josh went with it. That was fine. But to be honest, I have seen that on Twitter, and that was not everyone. Yeah. If people kind of go, are you saying that was me? Well, not necessarily. It may not have been you. You may have had quite a robust exchange, but it wasn't frenzied, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't vitriolic.
Exactly. Yeah.
But we can't change our spots. And we had a conversation beforehand and said, you know, do we go in all Jeremy Paxman and do, you know, 18 hours of research and ask questions about, you know, who paid his taxes in whatever, or what organizations he linked to. And we said, no, actually, we're not going to do that, because that's not who we are.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, whilst his answers may not have been what people wanted to hear, you know, we asked questions that were relevant to us in our position. You know, we aren't here to represent a community that we're not a part of. And that's kind of, you know, another part of it, isn't it? You know, it's, you know, the care review is as it says on the tin, really. And you know, that's really it, really. I just think that, you know, people need to realize we were interviewing him. We aren't Josh McAllister. We're not part of the care review. We are not paid by anybody to interview anybody. You know, we do this as a hobby. And I think that, I know. Yeah. If we are paid, it would make your company seem a bit more worthwhile. But, you know,
take the sting out of every conversation.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's what bugs me, is the fact that, you know, this is a hobby for us, in terms of, you know, we bring our personal experience to the adoption and fostering podcast, and to be kind of, targeted by messages and tweets and things like that. Actually, it's not nice, guys. And, you know, you put yourself on social media, you have to expect some of it. But for some of us, you know, to read kind of written form in out of context, because sometimes it is out of context, it's not a nice thing. So, you know.
I was okay with it all, I think.
No, you're all right. You've been replying to people. You've been challenging back. You've been...
Well, I'm happy to push back, because I don't think I have to justify anything to anyone. I'm not the bloody BBC. I don't have to be balanced. Actually, I don't have to be balanced, because I'm not a public servant. And I have my views on the care review. And but I didn't necessarily express those. And I'm a pragmatist by nature. I'm not. And I embrace some of the views that have concerns. I totally am on board with that.
But and I totally agree with you on that. Yeah, totally agree with you on that, because I do as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, we didn't treat him any differently to the way we would have treated any other guest, you know? That's it.
Yes, that's fair enough, isn't it? I mean, I guess it's difficult. And I think that I can understand the frustration, perhaps, that that Josh afforded us access that other people maybe haven't been afforded. That might be the one fair criticism, not of us, but of of Josh. But I don't know if they've asked, and I don't know what he said to them. So again, we didn't Grosny Palms. We didn't promise, you know, favourable conversations. And we probably just listened and thought, these two halfwits will never get to the bottom of it. if it was, you know what I mean? if that was his intention. Yeah, well, yeah, okay. That, you know, the northern halfwit will never outwit me. I just think we asked, he said yes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know. Yeah. And he said he would come back again. So, you know, I'm up for that. I think when the review comes out, we'll see what the proof of the pudding is, you know.
Yeah.
Fun and games.
Anyway, shall we move on from that? Because I feel like we needed to get that out of there. Oh. I felt I needed to get that out of there. And it's out of there now, and that's it.
Yeah, it's still going on. I'm still having.
Yes, I know. I saw them. I saw them today.
Yeah. Interesting private messages with someone who thinks I'm the devil. But anyway, I don't think they think I'm the devil. I think they think I'm just a patsy, a government shill. Let's call me a government shill. I'm happy with that.
Are these messages to your own private personal account? Is it?
No. These. I don't know.
Oh, right. Maybe, okay. Yeah. No, okay. I know the ones you mean.
Yeah,
I've seen them.
Yeah, you have seen them. I've seen you not. I've noticed you're not joining in anyway.
I'm not engaging. No. Oh, the only engagement I did today was I was so incensed by one of the messages that I ended up hoovering and mopping my kitchen floor out of frustration before I just killed something, whether it be a bee or I would never kill bees. I've got a little strip in my garden for the bees. But yeah. That's where we're at with this. So, yeah, my kitchen floor got cleaned, so everybody's happy. The dog can now eat things off it and stuff. So.
Well, that's a window into your home life, just throwing food on the floor for the dog. Anyway, but let's not... Yeah. I know you're... Anyway. Hey-ho.
Yeah, anyway.
That's been interesting, but I think we knew that was coming. But more to the point, we're speaking to Professor Julie Selwyn. Not much point talking about it before we talk about it. But I'm really, to be honest, I'm slightly nervous because I'm a little bit of a fanboy. There you go.
Oh yeah. Oh okay.
Yeah. Because
I'm excited as well, but more because I want to. So obviously, you know, all the research that she did that was published. What? 4 years ago, 5 years ago, is it?
Not 2014. Beyond the adoption order, which is
is it that long ago?
Yes.
Oh,
seminal piece of work, yeah. Which you can look at everything that's come off the back of that.
Yeah.
Really excited to talk about that. So that's to talk to Julie.
And I'm interested to see how it's moved on, if it has. What's changed?
Yeah.
How she's been? Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
It is. But by the time this comes out, people, we live. There's no time to give questions, so I apologise. That's deeply frustrating for anyone listening.
Sorry about that.
Scott, I have been. I'm conscious that we haven't really done a bit of a roundup, and I can think of a few topics, but I was just a few things have happened on social media, and a few things have been pointed towards me, and I'm just thinking we're at a bit of an unusual point in relation to adoption. We can talk about adoption, I think, and also in just the way sort of. Between here and there, I think, in the UK. And it's interesting days, I think. And I know that there's probably some announcements coming. I can't say what they are because I'm not sure whether it's confidential or not. But I think
they are probably.
You know they are. Oh, do I? Right, okay.
We were told not to say anything.
Oh, well, I usually think they're speaking about someone else when they're saying
I knew you were going to say something like that. You did this once before with something else. And when there is something happening in a couple of weeks, we're not going to say what. But last time this happened, Al went out and just did it on Twitter.
Right. Well, that was because
you got an email.
I didn't get an angry email. I got
no, but you got a shut up, Al email.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was about the Adoption Support Fund, wasn't it, over Christmas?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Yeah. And how the...
Yeah.
Well, that just indicated a real frustration. I'm happy to talk about that because I think that was really frustrating that there was an announcement saying the Adoption Support Fund was going to be extended for another year. So this is historic. This is going back to last Christmas. And all my point was, why can't we tell people this before Christmas? Because it's good news. Yeah. It's a lot of people are really anxious about it. But then they didn't. And then someone who knew accidentally leaked it onto Twitter. And then the minute they did it, I thought, right, we're in here. It's not my fault, but I'm certainly going to surf that wave, baby.
Yeah, exactly. And also the other frustration is another year. So we're going year to year with it, you know. Oh, yeah. God. You know, because our children and adopted teenagers and, you know, teenagers' special guardianships and blah, blah. That's all, you know, their life is just 1 year, isn't it? You know, I mean, let's face it, you know, rather than actually thinking ahead. Anyway. Yeah.
No, that's fine. I got sent, Helen Bonnick emailed me and said, oh, there's this really interesting piece of research. And I thought that would be helpful to talk about maybe.
You did send it to me, didn't you?
I think I did, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
No, I'm not sure I did.
I'm not a chance.
Anyway, yeah, you did. Don't worry. And it was in relation to adoption disruption. And I thought off the back of the conversation that we had a few weeks ago in relation to safeguarding and adoption and safeguarding and fostering, it was a really interesting piece of research. I'm going to give you the title here now. Here it is. It's called Experiences of Adoption Disruption, Parents' Perspectives. And it's by Elizabeth Little, Paul McCaffrey and Brian J. Taylor. And they're from the University of, Belfast, I think. Ulster University. And sort of done it with a little bit of support from Adoption UK in Ireland. Is that what they're called? Adopt an Ireland. You know that.
Adoption UK, NI.
And I just thought it was really fascinating because I think it's an area, even referring back to what Julie Selman had said about the Beyond the Adoption Order, it was kind of hinted at. And there's just constant, you see organisations like Special Guardians Adopters Together there, it's one of their key kind of messages about how local authorities deal with it, how it's managed, how it's supported post-breakdown, what is a breakdown, what is a disruption? Is it a breakdown of the relationship or is it a breakdown of the actual legal relationship? A lot of really complicated questions. But what was really interesting, and I think, is that because anecdotally, most people who've been around this community long enough have kind of, you can look at stuff and sort of say to people, well, you'll know people who've experienced it or you'll know of people. We can draw conclusions about why that's happened. But it was interesting to see some actual empirical research to say, hey, these are some actual reasons. So are you on board with this conversation?
I am very much on board with this conversation.
So they sort of highlight very much that it's associated with three primary factors, and that is older children adoptions. It's a high prevalence.
That's interesting. Yes. Really? What is older? What is older?
That is a really good question. Well, I mean, I think in the UK context, we'd say five and above is older. Would that be the...
I find that so interesting because, and I mean, I'm a very, very small piece of the older adoption thing. I know that, right?
But because your children were 8 and 7, weren't they?
Yeah, 8 and 7 and 7. And so that is a lot older in comparison to 5. But we also know that up to kind of 9 have been placed for adoption in the past. So I find that a very interesting thing because I always, when I think about the kind of the setup and the layout of her family now, so many years on, you know, like Brandon was 22 yesterday, Fraser is 23 last month, and Jacob is 15 in a couple of weeks. And I just... you know, we've gone through our struggles and what have you, but I don't know if maybe I'm ignorant to it, if that makes sense. Maybe I just take it all on my own shoulders. I don't know, but I kind of assign some of all of that to the fact that they were a little bit older. So I'm not part of this research. I'm not part of this research. No, I didn't take part in it.
Well, actually, it's referenced here.
I just find it really intriguing.
It's referenced here by, it is referenced Julie Selwyn's research. So that's, the snake is eating itself, which was 2015. I forgive me, it's not 2014. She probably, I was thinking when she was
she'll
writing.
She'll rip you a new one.
She will. She'll snap mine like a dry twig. She'll take none of this Josh McAllister nonsense, Dr. Julie, Professor Julie Selwyn. She'll keep us two in check. She said that, 3.2%. But also that approximately 25% of adoptions encountered serious difficulties. Now that's 2015, it's only 6 years ago. I would imagine they're similar. But again, it's just that you get into these really complicated conversations about what is a disruption.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, And the move towards older adoptions, Krish Kandaya, head of the SIA, Adoption Special Guardian Leadership Board, has sort of got one of his, I don't know, one of his interests is older adoptions. And when he, when we mm-hmm. say yeah. older adoptions, he's thinking of like more like a US at 15, 16, 17. So the foster children are not aging out into the that whole dynamic. Which is culturally not our norm, but in the US is more normal. I don't know whether how normal, but it is more normal. Anyway, the second point. Inability. it's okay. It's a long. Going to be a long night. Instability. let me get to it. Instability.
I was only laughing. I didn't say anything. Jesus.
Instability in couple relationships, unrealistic expectations, inflexibility, and unwillingness to seek help as being part of the.
Okay.
Which makes perfect. Yeah. Interesting that the instability in couple relationships, which I think, again, we come back to that, the impact of caring for children who experience adversity wobbles.
Yeah, and also the kind of the experience that perhaps one of the one or both of the parents have had in the past in terms of their own childhood or, you know, whatever, and also the reasons for coming to adoption, you know, if there's been an issue around infertility or something like that, you know, you just don't know kind of what, you know. So again,
the potential for all that. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the third factor is shortcomings in adoption services.
Who knew? Yeah. Who knew?
Well, that's news to me.
But that's quite broad, isn't it? If you think about it, because that is quite broad. If you look at, you know, since the ASF has come into play, right? So we're thinking about 2015, Julie Selwyn's Beyond Adoption Order. The ASF came in 2015.
It was piloted in 2015, across 10 local authorities.
Yeah, local authorities, and then it was rolled out. However, even though the ASF is here, we still know that there are a number of agencies whose workers, social workers, potentially don't see what others see in terms of adoption, in terms of support.
Yeah.
So I think that's really interesting, and that might actually be something that we want to kind of flesh out a little bit with Professor Julie Selwyn, because, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it says here that includes preparation and inadequate support, and I think those are. I mean, like you say, that the ASF is wonderful, but it's neither use nor ornament if you can't get access to it.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that phrase. Neither use nor ornament.
Do you used to say that makes me smile. When you're a child?
Yes, we did. My granny used to say that.
He's got your neither use nor ornament.
She used to also say you're about as much use as a chocolate fire guard. But yeah. Anyway.
But I just think it's really interesting, and I'd really recommend people. I'll put a link to it, but I think it's paid. Yes. So that's a bit of a pain. But I sort of said, where can I get it? On Twitter, and then about 18 people goes, I can give you a copy, but don't tell us all.
So you definitely sent it to me, because that was definitely what you sent me. Yes, thank you.
I didn't send you the link. I sent you a PDF. So, you know.
No, you sent the proper thing. So if anybody wants
a PDF. Oh, that's it.
Go to noborders.org and noborderstraining.org and send us a message.
And you can deal with the legal issues when the owners of the document come and find you. And I'm on sabbatical in out of Mongolia. Get me. Bugs alive.
Mongolia.
You can't
go to Mongolia at the minute, sorry.
Yeah, you're probably right.
You might have to go to, I don't know, Somerset.
Somerset.
Comparable.
So, I don't know. Comparable.
Somewhere far away.
I've been to Somerset. I'm going to say Somerset when I was a child. Happy memories. Ladybird invasion. Anyway. There was a couple of other things to unpick, and it is really quite detailed about the different things. But one of them, the families that they looked at, several of them, quite high proportion, experienced investigation by the child protection team and police because of an allegations by the child. All of the investigations, there was eight families experienced that. All but one investigations were dropped and the children remained at home. However, parents spoke of the procedure as highly distressing and undermining their parental role, and that having a sort of a cumulative effect or being part of that, just that broader context that just pushed them off the edge. Which I think, you know, I've got friends who've, you know, recently had an allegation, and it's just absolutely devastating. Just You know, they know the system. They know it's not true. They're professionals, but they've got to do this dance, which again reflects what Josh was saying. The interim report from the Care Review saying that an increase in 129% of child protection investigations, and you kind of think that's really corrosive for the people involved, isn't it?
Yeah.
In it, champion. So that was that, and I really recommend people looking into that, and we'll probably unpick some of that with Dr. Professor. She probably is a doctor.
Professor.
She will be a doctor.
Come on.
Yeah.
She's a professor, isn't she?
Well, I think it's... Yeah, she'd be...
What's higher?
I think anyone can be a doctor, but to be a professor, you're kind of linked to a...
Well, can I be a doctor?
Yes. From now on, we'll call you Dr. Scott. Dr. Scott. Well, anyone, but you need, professor is like a role within an academic organisation, so you kind of...
Right, okay.
Doctor's a qualification, professor's a role, I think. We'll ask her.
Okay.
We'll ask her.
And no doubt by then, people will have gone on the keyboard and told us, so...
Yes. Don't worry, though. Dr. Scott, we'll all be fine. Dr. Scott.
I feel like that's a little bit shut up, Scott. Move on.
Oh, I'll move on quickly. The other thing I was wanting to talk to you about is, do you know, I had a real, you know, you talked about being absolutely livid in relation to a direct message that you'd seen, and you had to do some furious hoovering, it sounds like a passive aggressive sport. I used to work with a man who used to, if he was stressed, he would get, it was like his, he ran the business, you know, it's like 30 people work there. And you could tell when he was stressed because he would start hoovering. He would just randomly...
Oh, really?
He'd go and get the hoover out and he'd be hoovering frantically, trying to... it was a very odd place. You wouldn't have liked it because the carpets, it was a steel fabrication shop. So there was lots of oil in the workshop, just, you know, from cutting steel. But it got dragged into the offices, so the carpets...
Oh, that'd be my worst nightmare.
The carpets were sticky, but sticky with oil.
Oh.
And there'd be bits of swarf, you know, the steel swarf.
Do people work in these conditions? Ugh.
Oh, well, I worked at a place, there was several workshops, and there was this one down the road, I'll not name the name of it, but every Christmas I had the job of, I did this for years, he would say, right, go and give out all the calendars and say a happy Christmas from us, you know, people we've worked with. And I went to this other place, and it was literally like a living, like it was like Del Boy's living room, and that was their office. So between the secretary and the managing director, there was a fish tank set into the wall. And so there was a floral pattern wallpaper, like from, you know, with three ducks on it. And a big patterned carpet that was sticky, literally squelched when you walked on it. And I walked into his office and he was sat there, and he was a larger fellow, like in his maybe 60s or his 70s. And he went, oh, hiya, son, because I was like 30. And I looked, and he was using his desk to feed his cat, and he just literally was pouring cat food onto the corner of his desk.
And there was
cats everywhere. And then I looked, and there was like seven or eight cats. And you know those cat homes? In the corner of the office, there was a cat home, and I was thinking, this is just the world of strange. That's not a funny anecdote, but it's just...
No.
DM me, I'll tell you where it is, and you can go and get something made there.
It's a window into your life.
Life. Yeah. I worked at this really... It was a really odd place called Seaton Delaval in Northumberland, and really odd experiences. So things like people would come in and not bring money, but they'd bring black pudding. So they want like a half a meter of a bit of steel, and they literally would bring black pudding and go. And so everyone would get he'd pull out a knife, and we'd all get like 2 inches of a bit of like a huge full size black pudding. He'd cut it up, and we'd all get a piece.
This sounds like olden times.
Yeah, but it was really odd, and we'd find people in the, you know, those guys who would come in just for the crack, and they would be having races with the mobility scooters in the workshop yard. It was just the world of the strange. I have no idea how we got to that point.
Well, I do, because you said that there was something incensed you.
Furious.
And I know what it is, but off you go.
You know, there was those unfortunate months where it became really clear that people were very unhappy about people oversharing about their adopted children on social media.
I remember it very well.
very, very legitimate criticism.
Yep, which majority of us have have looked inside, acknowledged our mistakes and made changes. Yeah.
I mean, I've taken down some posts. Actually, as recently as a few months ago, I went back through about the last, because I've got millions of blogs. I couldn't be bothered. I got up to about 50 and I gave up. But I took out specific ones for some really good reasons. And I just thought, actually, nah, it's a bit too close to the knuckle, or it's a bit too revealing. But I went onto a blog, and this, I'll tell you what the blog said, because I was genuinely gobsmacked. So it was talking about children, and they were talking about children who weren't no longer getting contact letters from their biological parents. And the question was, I don't know how I'm going to tell my child when they get older. And I and there was, but there was also a photograph of the child. So it wasn't like a, you know, like you and I would do a photograph of a, a stock photo or a random photo. And I just thought,
we're still there. We're still there.
Yeah. I was genuinely like, but you're saying you don't know how to tell them, but you're telling every other person in the world has got access to that. And I just thought, wow, what is that about? I just, is it just that, is it like, you know, wedding magazines, you know, there's, you only need about 10 months of different editions, because by the time people get to the end of it, it's a new set of people looking at a wedding. So they just roll them out like pregnancy magazines. They just have nine editions and they just keep them rolling. Is it that the adoption... Well, it's true, isn't it? You only need nine editions for a pregnancy magazine.
True, yeah.
Because then people move on. But the same within our community, that people, that the lessons learned by the generation before are just being forgotten. And I just see this whole rise... and it's not stuck to a particular format or a particular community, but just people starting to really overshare again. And I don't know how to address it. I mean, is it my job to address it? Is it my job to kind of privately go, oh, excuse me, I saw this. Does that make me an arse? I don't know. I mean, I'm an arse for lots of other reasons, but not that one.
You are. Yeah, true. Yeah.
Furious Hoover.
I think... Well, I know the blog because I sent you the link, but because I thought, what could I do to wind Al up today?
Oh, I was spinning feathers for about 4 hours, furiously hoovering. Oh,
I can imagine. I can imagine. I should think Mrs. C was delighted.
Oh, she, a whole lot of them left me to it.
I'm sure she actually had to go back over it when you're done. Yeah, it's an interesting one because, again, we go back to, we've mentioned this a couple of times, haven't we? Yeah. This kind of sale of adoption, and that's what it is. We're, you and I used to share blogs and share information that we, that got questioned, as did a number of other people get questioned on it.
I don't think I ever got questions.
Oh, did you not? Well, lucky you, because I didn't, but I saw it to other people, and I thought, okay, maybe I've gone too far with this or the next thing. And you're right. I think that it's a generational thing in some ways. I also think that some of the blogs that are coming through now, bearing in mind you and I are kind of old school. yeah, exactly. you know, I'm quite proud to have been the first same-sex couple that went through our local authority to adopt. However, there is another generation of same-sex couples who are coming through, and they are doing different things to promote adoption. I guess where we're coming from with this discussion is the fact that there's a point where oversharing becomes too much. Now, be proud to be a parent, be proud to be a parent through adoption, be proud to be a same-sex couple who've adopted, be proud to be whatever you want to be proud of. But for goodness sake, stop selling your children, because that is exactly what you're doing. Because these blogs are also an income. But
that's different. That's the difference.
They are, but they're all they're related. They are related. Okay, so the ones that we're referring to, and I'm not going to name and shame because I don't want to be like that.
But if you DM Scott, he'll tell you.
Yeah, quite happy to, as long as you're nice. If you're nice, I'll tell you. If you're not, I won't. But it's all, there's a kind of income related to this. Now, I never had that. I'm never asked you. I'm supposing you never had that. I did it once, actually. That's a lie. Did it once, a McCain family advert, and we sat down and I spoke to both the boys about it, because Fraser was away in America at the time, and spoke to both the boys and I said, look, we've been approached to do this. Do you want to do it? Because at the end of the day, it's their decision. Yeah. And of course, they did want to do it because there was money in it. I think I've said this before.
So money and
that
chips.
That was the one time. Yeah. No, we didn't get any chips. The evil Egypts didn't send us nothing, honestly.
I'd have demanded a lifetime of chips.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a one-off. It was a one-off. And to be honest with you, it didn't really sit with me. I've done interviews that I've asked the boys if they wanted to be involved in. So we did a Sky News interview on siblings. We did an ITV interview about First Christmas for Jacob. It was all stuff that we were approached for, but I asked them, and we never, not once, apart from the McCain thing, did we ever get any financial recompense for it. But these are different. These are different because these are intentionally sharing stuff to then promote and to be sponsored and to be hashtag ad, as they have to put on Instagram now if they're promoting something. And I just think it's not the right way. These kids deserve anonymity and privacy. Okay, there's a number of biological parents who would never put their children online with their faces, with their names, etc., because they believe that that's a decision for them to make when they're older. And it's different if it's just a Facebook page, as in your Facebook profile, and you're sharing with your friends, and it's, you know, private and blah blah blah. That's different. This is publicly selling.
It's odd, isn't it? Because it is slightly different. It is, I think it's that nuance of you're sharing a very private, by the very definition of saying we're an adoptive family, you're sharing a private, yep, private information, yep, which mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily mean people get questions to that, but yep, that it's inherently, I know some of my children have experienced sort of bullying because of being adopted, mm-hmm. or negative comments, or they felt vulnerable because of that, and they've wanted to keep it private. Mm-hmm. And that's them as teenagers. But as I know for a fact, if I'd have asked them at six, they'd have said yes to anything.
Yeah, like, exactly. You know, yeah. Mm-hmm. Kids are
like. Yeah, and you can, and if you're getting nice things, then why not? It's hard, isn't it? Because I feel like we're being really specifically critical. However, I feel that it's something that's, we've danced around it an awful lot, but I think it's just, I just think it's not appropriate that
I agree.
If it's a biological child is different, but again, like you said, some people are quite, very protective of that.
But let's put it this way, Al, like we've listened to the adoptee community and they've said, how dare you share information like that about your child? Now, these are adults who've been adopted and who would never have wanted that information shared. So why are we not listening to them? Why are we not acknowledging they may have a point? You know, a lot of us have, and I can think of various names, and I'm sure you can as well, especially on Twitter as an example, who use pseudonyms. They use initials for their children, or they use pseudonyms for their children. They may share stuff, but actually, unless you were digging deep into the internet, you wouldn't know who they were. And I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that. I know probably the majority of them in real life because I know of them, and the same way you do. But actually, when it comes to the public thing, they're looking for support. They're looking for, advice and, from kind of the older adopters who maybe have been through it, So they've come onto that kind of platform for advice and support. That's fine. But that's a different thing. That's a completely different thing.
Yeah, and I think that I think there's a whole range of ways you can look at it, and I think that as a community, there was probably that period of adoptive parents who were perhaps overshared as a community. Mm-hmm. Generally, we perhaps said a little bit too much. Some people more, some people less. Yeah. But we were attacked. Maybe the way we were attacked is not particularly helpful, but a lot of people went away, and some people just shut their stuff down and went. Some people listened and said, fair point.
Yeah.
But
I think the tide turned at that point for me. That's when the tide started to turn for me, because I was like, actually, I've never had this before. Like you, I probably wasn't specifically kind of engaged with on that. I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that I wasn't using a pseudonym or anything like that, because some of it was about, you know, oh, you think your pseudonym is you know, privacy, but it's actually not. There was a lot of that. But at the end of the day, you know, you are you and I was me on social media. I started off as gay adoption dad with no name and very kind of locked down and, you know, no mention of kind of names and initials and all that sort of stuff. But as time went on, you know, my kids were comfortable with it. They were old enough to say, knowing that there was no, you know, there was nothing in it for them, but knowing that actually it could help us as a family. And difference.
I found being myself quite a protective factor, because it meant that everything was identifiable. So then it made me very, really careful about what I said. So I thought...
there's that as well. Yeah.
And on the odd occasion, I wrote an article for Community Care. And actually, Community Care approached me and asked me to write an article in relation to sibling contact that, you know, and sort of families reaching out. And I spoke to my children about a specific incident that I used in that article, and my children were fine about that. They were adults. You know, they weren't 16, 17, or 5 or 6. They were, you know, in their 20s, mid-20s, and went, no, that's fine. I'm happy with that. I think
that's on our website, isn't it?
I see what you did there.
On noborderstraining.org.
Goodness, you're so smooth.
that digital marketing certificate is on its way, mate.
I tell you, wow. Distinction, top of the class. For you, definitely. But I think the whole issue of consent around the nature of children's vulnerability, the power dynamics of children, you know, children are suggestible, persuasive, and children are short-term goals, gains, aren't they? You know, hey, we can go to Blackpool if we post 5 photographs of ourselves having a fun time as this kind of adoptive family. But when you're 19, you might go, oh, I'm not sure I feel so comfortable about that. At that point, does everything have to be deleted? And is there a sort of a fracture with an adult brain going, oh, hang on, was I...
You sold
us. A commodity? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, there'll be some kids who go, no, I was fine. I loved every bit of it. And, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
All those chips.
I mean, that's the other side of it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And that 20 quid. fine, isn't
slipped
it?
Slipped you 20 quid. There's,
but I just think that, you know, I mean, that's up to the adult then to decide if they're comfortable with it. But we're making a decision based on the excitement of, oh, well, you could be on the telly, or you could be in the paper, or you can be in this magazine. That's very different. Because, you know, as a child, I would have done. I wanted to be famous when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. You know?
Who didn't, you know?
Yeah, it is really complicated. But when you're 19,
like you say, when you're 19, 20, you might not be like that. So, you know, let's
25.
Just have a little bit of... Well, or 30, you know. Well, and some of the stuff I did anonymously, I wonder, what was I thinking? Why did I say those things, you know? Mm-hmm. It was a different time, a different kind of experience.
Well, I think that it reflects that we need to listen to adopted adults more and just, you know, we only get a slither of the community, you know, there's whatever. There's over 100,000 adopted adults in the UK, but we only get a wafer-thin slither. The recurring themes are, it's my story, but everyone owns it. You know, I think every one of them has sort of somewhere reflected the idea that they don't feel necessarily a sense of ownership, especially when they don't know when that story is incomplete, that, you know, that perhaps a birth parent holds part of a story that is not accessible to them, and a social worker owns another part of a story, and a foster care another part. Mm. Whereas for me as a biological child, my story was held by one person, my mum, who I was living with. And I just find that all really fascinating, how that can then really, it can never be resolved. You can never get to the bottom of it. But to add into the mix of that, then your story then being broadcast. And I think it was the specific nature of the of that idea that you're saying, this child doesn't know this, how on earth am I going to tell them? And you go, you've just bloody told the world, man. There's some kid who'll find him on Facebook and tell him, you know, when he's 10, mm-hmm. if you haven't told him. And that's private. That is private information that's complicated around birth family not being in touch. And there could be a whole raft of stuff about that, but that's no one's business. Anywho, that's got me wound right up.
Yeah. I'll tell you what's got me wound up, because I was just getting bored of listening to your voice. And you've posted on Twitter our conversation from earlier. It's not like that every week.
Overshare.
Yeah.
I'm a hypocrite. I forgive you. Yeah, just
you are. Yes. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. If you've seen it on Twitter, you'll know what we're talking about.
Yeah, just a slight microphone issue prior to recording beginning. There's a whole raft of things there that you've got. So I think that that's probably, I mean, we could go on and I will go on. There is some stuff I've been to a transracial, the race disparity adoption group today, and that was actually really encouraging. That was really good. It feels quite interesting to think about alternative ways of raising adoption within communities of colour, and which includes lots of different cultures and ethnicities and nationalities and faiths. And that was really, I was actually really encouraged. And for a long time, I've been quite discouraged by that. But actually, it was genuinely nice to be in a room where I was the only white person. And I'm there kind of from a transracial point of view.
I think it's interesting as well, because it's been brought up before, this thing about transracial adoption, hasn't it? But it's not really been focused in on. And I think that that's what's interesting about this group that you're a part of, is that, you know, it's kind of transitioned into, you know, you're the only white person in that room. And that's a good thing, because that's not how it's always been.
No.
So, you know, it's great that it's been taken so seriously, because I think it needs to be. And, you know, we can see all of this, this kind of campaign to try and recruit people from different backgrounds rather than just, you know, your traditional white male and female. Actually, it's not before time. It needed to be done, and I'm just delighted to see it being taken so seriously in whatever element, you know, it is.
Yeah, and it just really made me think about how people come to, like, I mean, I think there's two sort of issues. One is that of recruiting more people who reflect the ethnicity, colour, culture, nationality, faith of the children who need adopting or fostering. But also the issue of transracial. And it sort of dawned on me that often no one comes into adoption thinking, very few people will go, oh, I want to adopt a black baby. In those terms, what may happen is that they'll just go through the assessment process and they'll go to panel, which is, you know, quite intensive. Mm-hmm. And then a match comes up that is perhaps involves a child of a different ethnicity, culture, race, all of that. But at that point, you're already assessed. And the assessment, is really unlikely that the assessment will have in any way reflected your capability or capacity to care for a child of a different culture, colour. And I thought, oh, that's really clicked in my head. So what preparation are we giving parents and matching? You know, what is the level of assessment? Because it will be just, you know, what is it? And I just thought that's a really interesting question about how people then find themselves, because the clock is ticking, they've found a match. Can we get these adopters through? Is that, how big a part is that in the matching process? Is it, you know, do people have additional preparation? I think maybe they do, maybe they don't, depends where they live. Anyway, that's an issue for another day. But there's a few people we're getting on, I'd like to get on in the future. There's just too many guests and not enough time, basically. That's the problem with our podcast.
True that.
I think the last thing I was going to say, which has literally just escaped my mind, was in relation to, I've been, and you have been, beavering away trying to get the voices of birth parents. And that's a road less travelled, if there ever was one. So I think we even need to dedicate a podcast to it without any on, because I think of the, negotiations makes it sound difficult, but the safeguards we've had to put in place for some of the people we've spoke to have been just really quite stark, really. Yeah.
I mean, you sent me the recording that you did a week ago, 10 days ago. And I mean, you said it was rough to listen to, and it was so candid, and I mean, I could just feel the pain of that situation. You know, unusually, because if we were able to listen to every podcast that we did or every conversation that we did, and you know, it'd be lovely. Sadly, we don't. But that one specifically just really made me think long and hard, shall we say, long and hard about, you know, where we're at with adoption and stuff, and other and people's positions within that, you know, and how we support them. And you know, I think that's where. I'm not doing a selfless plug here, but I am, because when we talked about No Borders initially, that was one of the things that we wanted to kind of do, was not just focusing on children who had previously been looked after or who were adopted or who were in special guardians, but also those families who actually are struggling, you know, biological families who are struggling and can't access support. Yeah. And actual fact, some of it crosses over, and you know, because we've been in that position, and because a lot of, you know, some of our trainers have been kind of working with families in that position, but it's not just accessible. You know, it's like, oh, have you done the Webster Stratton? Well, yes or no. And well, off you go and do that, and then everything will be perfect and you'll be a fine family again. And that's it. You know, it doesn't work like that. So, you know, I think that's where, you know, we kind of acknowledge that journey for birth parents. And, you know, it may not help, but you know what, if it helps one family just to kind of get their head around why their child is, you know, why they're experiencing violent or aggressive behavior from their children, then, you know, why not?
Yeah, but I think even the work, I know you're planning training on FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and I think, again, that is it's a big part of our community, the community we sort of come out of. But it's dwarfed by the impact on the wider community of children, 11 million children. There's 11 million children in the UK. But I think that's where we want to take some of the stuff we've learned and kind of share it with those communities, because I think we don't necessarily realise how stark it is outside of adoption world. You know, we can sometimes, it's damned by fate and praise, really, but things are okay here. But that doesn't mean it's not harder than adoption and fostering. It's still, you know, every day you just have to look on social media and see people struggling to get support. But step outside of this community and you'll see that we've got a lot more than other people. So I think that we want to broaden that out. And then I was going to do like a comedy, you know, if you've listened to this podcast, you could listen to another podcast. Is that a good advert to do at the end? Well, I guess if people will indulge us, we've got a few minutes to talk about No Borders, which is what Scott's been talking about. But we're doing No Borders is just this idea of training that's slightly different. It's usually by people who either lived experience, but also academically underpinned, not just, you know, simple but happy people like me, people who've got some academic background and also can bring some real learning and experience to bear to subject matter. So we're doing resilience in September. There'll be a link in the podcast blurb, so you can go and find it. But we're doing, Scott and I are going to do transitions in the autumn. We'll put the date on there. But we're also doing little mini podcasts through the No Borders podcast. So if you like this one, go along, subscribe, put a review on our podcast, of course, but we'll put the links in all of the blurb. And please go along there, because we want to do something different, but we don't want it to be just a money-making scam. We want people to get something from it. So the podcasts, the little mini podcasts will be like bite-sized snacks. If you want the meal, come on the training.
Like that.
Your little advertising head's done a whirly gig, hasn't it?
Oh, it's just gone.
Yeah. You'd be up all night worrying about that.
I will, memes. Yeah. Thinking of things to say and do, not.
What we've also got, we're resurging? Regurgitating? Reliving? Regurgitating is probably the best.
I don't know what you're talking about, so until you said it, I don't know which would fit.
Our annual conference. We're regurgitating the annual conference.
Regurgitating would mean that we're just wheeling out the same rubbish that we did last year.
Okay. And we're not. It's not rubbish at all.
No, we are definitely not. And it wasn't rubbish last year either, to be fair.
Nicely saved. But we're going to talk about identity and adoption. We're going to do a whole day on that. We're going to, and so we'll, again, details to be in. But I mean, it's a way off now. It's November the 26th. Put in the diary and we'll get details. And it's going to be cheap as chips.
There's more before then.
Yeah. There's more. Stack them high, sell them cheap.
If you want to have a look at what we're doing, then go to noborderstraining.org. And then you can, there's a number of pages on there, the training and events pages there. So that'll give you details of some of the stuff that's coming up.
Pictures of you and me.
Okay. There is on the About Us page, as well as some of our trainers, which we are adding to. We've had some really great conversations, actually, and we've engaged with some fantastic people who will be training for us. We've just got to wait on them sending with us, sending their biographies and headshots from their prison photographs.
None is as worse as the one you found for me off the internet, which made me look like a... It made me look like a cross between a Hell's Angel and a social worker.
That for the future. I'm keeping that. It's saved on my desktop. It's actually my screensaver.
You know, that day was probably one of the worst days of my entire life. That day I had...
Oh, really?
Literally. I can talk about it now. Yeah. But literally, Paul rang me about 30 seconds later and said, you need to come home from London. And I could hear screaming. Lots of screaming in the background. No. All of the kids screaming. She said, you need to get on a train right now. And so literally I just dropped everything I was holding and I just got on the train. Anyway.
That's probably, so you probably related that fall to that trauma. It's rather than that fall, it's the trauma that went with that.
I run cold at the very thought of it. That and Christmas cake. Have you ever told you about my Christmas cake story? I can't eat LNER or see LNER Christmas cake without literally my blood running cold.
Really?
Yeah,
you're quite a complex character. So
I am, but really, like if I go into an LNER buffet, which is the train, London North East Railways, they have little packets, lovely little slabs of Christmas cake wrapped up. And it was back in the day when I got the allegation and I was all, you know, I was interviewed by the police. And the last thing I ate before someone said to me, I've got something to tell you, was that Christmas cake. And it's kind of, the two are intrinsically linked. I kind of see it as a bit of a bad omen when I see one. Mm-hmm. Not the people are wandering around with slabs of LNER Christmas cake.
No, I was going to say, But anyway, if you want to know where to send the Christmas cakes, go onto our website, noborderstraining.org. And we'll get them distributed at No Borders Towers.
There's several people who'll be out buying them now and throwing them.
And I'm sure there'll be different ones as well, like dog poo and then a bit of marzipan and icing on top, just to see if you
Oh, I don't know how we got to this point.
That's just your children.
That is just my children. Oh, bless them.
Anyway, I think we've done enough.
Oh, we've done more than enough.
Excuse me.
What have we got coming up in the next few weeks? I spoke to Carol Atherton, who is an adoptive parent, also a teacher, but also she's an author. I think she's written lots of stuff. And we talked about adoption in literature. So we might put that out as a, over the summer, as a kind of a neither this nor that episode.
Yeah.
Give us another break.
Well, it's, poor Carol.
Yeah. That's true. She contacted me and was really odd. And I said this to her before the interview. I said, you know, there's another Carol Atherton that I'm involved with. That sounds really bad.
Stalking.
my stalker. She's head of a governor's that I'm a part of. And I kept seeing these emails from Carol Atherton going, that's a really strange conversation Carol's trying to have with me. Then I realised it was a different one. Yeah. We've got Julie Selwyn. We've got the birth parents. Yeah. We've got some... we've got foster carer, got an adopter. We've got a bit of this, bit of that, bit of way, bit of woo.
We've got conversations coming out of our luggles.
We have. As quicker than you can listen to them, we've got them recorded. Anyway.
Yeah.
This might be the... Is this a dull podcast? I feel that we've got the dirty water of our chest.
I think it's going there. I think it's actually going there if it's not gone there already.
Champion. And I do want to do a podcast about faith, Christian.
I know. Stuff. Anyway, it's time to go.
Okay, then. And I will do that. That's my kind of my death. That'll be my deathbed wish.
Yeah, it will be. Yeah. Welcome to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Scott Cass and Rennie. That's it.
Interviewer two. That's where we end. That's yeah. where we started. That's where we ended. Well, as always, Bon Jovi.
Anchovy.
There you go. That was all right, wasn't it?
Tris thinks you've got a death wish, want to do a face one. He really does. He's kind of in the middle of the face thing, but he thinks that it could well be the kind of nail in the coffin of the...